One other question, and Bill, maybe I'll go to you on this one. A bit of context for the audience: China banned crypto in 2013. At least phase one was in 2013. The latest phase was in late 2021, and that was a pretty big ban there. So my question to you, Bill: if this is a testing ground in Hong Kong, and then China follows suit, what does that mean for crypto, and how has the market responded in the short term?
Yeah, can you hear me okay, Mario?
Perfect, yes, and
All
the
right.
birds.
So I have maybe a slightly different view. Is I actually think that it really doesn't mean much of anything. I think that people who want to buy crypto, even people in China, for the most part, are able to buy crypto, especially the folks that would move the market, whether it's institutional money, high net worth, family offices, banks, funds like Hasibs or Abras, whatever. They're able to buy crypto today. I don't know anyone who complains to me that, oh, I want to put $1 million in crypto and I just can't do it. I honestly have never heard that. Okay. Now, the regulatory environment is certainly hostile, but for people who are savvy and want to buy, they're able to buy. I think the bigger issue is that we're in this, at the we probably troughed in terms of where the global liquidity markets were in October, November of last year. And that's going to matter way more than what's happening in Hong Kong or with the Warren faction of crypto or anti-crypto or the Biden administration. And I think liquidity globally has actually been improving since November. So I'm going to maybe disagree with Mike a little bit here. I think the economy is now in recession in the US and Europe. We saw the Germany print PMI plummeted with huge downside risk, which probably creates a floor on global liquidity shorts if you look at it from a contrarian perspective, because I think liquidity is actually going to start increasing even from these levels. We might see some short-term downside risk on US-based risk on assets because I think the dollar on a relative basis may strengthen. But I think it's going to be short-lived, and I think it's going to be game on very soon. I think interest rates have peaked or very close to peaking. This reminds me of the early to mid-90s when everything was doom and gloom, when interest rates were rising, and all of a sudden the internet came storming in. And now in the same environment, when interest rates have probably peaked, we've got AI investments storming in at the same time. So all of this, to me, points to an environment where I actually think a lot of people are going to be very, very surprised to the upside over the next 24 months. Certainly going, probably more so next year than this year, but I would not be surprised if there was upside surprises this year in most risk on assets.
Bill, quick question to you before going to other panelists. And first, I like your bullishness. I like a bit of a contrarian here on the panel to balance it out. My question to you, though, is you said that the making the legalizing crypto in China won't make much of a difference. I don't understand how when the punishment if someone breaks the laws. I'll read out the te there's a 10-year up to 10 years imprisonment if someone in China trades or mines crypto, provides services related to crypto trading or mining, advertises or promotes crypto, holds crypto, or uses crypto to pay for
Sure.
goods and services. What, like I don't get how
It's
people would break the law.
very simple, and I think Julian can probably comment on this as well. I my take is that if you look at the amount of money movement by the wealthy who are able to get their money out via Hong Kong, who are able to move money into family offices, we have family office clients based in Hong Kong. We're sure a lot of that money originated in the mainland, and they're able to do what they want to do. Now, I think to your point, the lower middle class, who in the aggregate probably represent a lot of money, may have trouble because they can't easily use their everyday bank accounts via an exchange, may be shut out. But I think that's it's currently dwarfed by two things. One, the wealthy are able to do what they want to do, and two, global liquidity has been sucked out of the system anyway. So I think that as liquidity is being pushed and pumped into the system over the next 18 months, yes, that may actually help the mainland Chinese retail to some degree if it turns out that they actually turn that back on, which they're not even claiming to be doing here. That's just focused on Hong Kong. So I do think that for the most part, this is a liquidity driven issue, not a US regulatory issue, Chinese regulatory issue, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that we're going to basically be claiming that, oh, everything is great again because of all these relative regulatory overhangs that have been clarified in the next 24 months. And I can assure you that's not what it's going to be. It's going to be massive amounts of money being pumped into the system because of recession and other issues and bank failures and God knows what else that now that the debt ceiling's been raised, that are going to basically create game on again for risk on assets.
One more question to Jeremy on this one. Jeremy, and then I want to talk about the macroeconomy one more time before moving to whenever Scott is ready, we'll move to AI. But Jeremy, crypto corrected heavily when China cracked down. And if my memory's incorrect, please let me know. So I don't understand. Shouldn't crypto pump, considering China's shifting and opening up more to crypto, assuming Hong Kong is an experiment for the rest of China?
That's actually not
Jeremy?
correct, by the way.
Oh,
I'm
go ahead,
happy to
Bill.
jump in, but
Yeah,
I'll let
please, please.
Jeremy
Yeah, correct, correct. No, correct me, Bill, and then we'll go to Jeremy.
the timing may look correctly on a calendar, but if you actually look to overall global liquidity indices, I think maybe Bitcoin would have peaked at like 85 had China not cracked down. But the way liquidity was being starting to be pumped out of the system, we all, and I raised my hand as the first one, grossly underestimated the degree to which liquidity was going to be pumped out of the global system, early, late 21 going into last year, and through the mid-year for sure. And that was not about the Chinese crackdown. And by the way, look at the amount of mining still happening in China for a company that's banned, a country that's banned mining. I just don't buy it.
That makes
Jeremy?
perfect sense. Really
Go ahead,
quickly,
Bill.
Mario, I just want to say, yeah, and we will go to Jeremy right now, but that Bill's not the only person who's bullish on the rest of the year here. That's been a pretty actually popular narrative. I mean, 2 weeks ago, it was headline news that Paul Tudor Jones said that he believes the Fed is done raising rates, stocks will finish the year higher from here, and thought the same about the crypto market. So, as much as that's contrarian to what we've been discussing here, I think we're at one of those places in the market where we have really split sentiment 50-50 about what's going to happen moving forward. Jeremy, go ahead and share your thoughts. And Francis, I see your hand up as well. Jeremy, you're there if you're
You got
not.
to unmute, bottom left corner, Jeremy.
Hey, this is Jeremy Kaufman, the CEO of
Hey.
Library. We were
Go ahead, Jeremy.
one of the co This is Jeremy Kaufman, the CEO of Library. We were one of the companies that got hit by the federal government, as much as anyone. But this conversation, I feel like an alien a little bit listening to this conversation. I got into cryptocurrency. Actually, I was motivated by the original Operation Choke Point, the first one under the Obama administration, where he put extra legal pressure on the credit card companies to cause them to stop doing business with gun manufacturers, drug paraphernalia, pornography, sort of gray areas, but it was legal, and they put extra legal pressure and stopped those companies from being able to do business. And that, to me, was, and at least to me, still is the most fundamental value proposition of cryptocurrency. Not as some alternate reserve currency, to end the Fed, although let me be clear, I think it'd be great if that happens, but like that the fundamental thing that's interesting here and the fundamental thing that needs to exist for the whole thing to work is the ability to transact it freely, to have a world where if the credit card companies do say you can't do business, or if your government says you're not allowed to have that protest and we're going to take away your banking services, that cryptocurrency will make that kind of thing impossible. And 10 years later, it doesn't actually feel to me that that's true. And listening to this whole conversation, it doesn't even feel like people think that that's necessary anymore. That that's not even required. And all we care about is, can rich people buy and hold Bitcoin? And maybe that's a path to ending, fiat currency and all these things. So I'm not like trying to say that I'm wholly against that as a thing. But are we just done with the idea that you need to be able to transact, and the average person needs to be able to use it for this whole thing to work? Are we just done with that idea? That's kind of what I'd like to put out there to everyone else.
James, go ahead, please.
No, I mean, first of all, I agree with, and that's a good point, Jeremy. No, I think we do need the crypto, Bitcoin narrative. It's been US-centric in our little bubble here for a while, right? So, but the reality is that places like Lebanon and Venezuela and Argentina and places that are experiencing terrible inflation, super high inflation, even if the books don't say it's hyperinflation yet, they need a place to store their hard earned money without it melting away overnight. So that's number one, and they need to be able to transact. There's 1 billion people on this planet who are not banked, who are completely unbanked, and this is where Bitcoin in particular is important for them. But going back to what Bill was saying, look, I think that we exactly what you're saying, Scott, is that we're kind of split down the middle here between what people believe is going to happen in the next few months. We are bearing down on a recession. there's just no way around it. I do believe that AI is super important. It's going to create a lot of productivity. You know, some people will be displaced and some people will take advantage of the fact that they can do jobs of you know, five or 10 people when it used to, you know, take all those 10 people to produce certain things that AI will help them do. So it will be a boost to the economy eventually. Not quite yet. It will get there, though. But in the meantime, the Fed is bearing down on some conflicting data, right? So we've got jobs numbers that came in, a lot of job openings, $10 million job openings this morning. And then you've got the inflation has been so sticky that they're continuing with the Fed narrative of they've got to reduce inflation and they're going to keep raising rates to do that. So now we're seeing that the market's expecting another rate raise. And if we do that, look, you cannot raise rates over 500 basis points in less than a year without some sort of impact to the economy. And the economy is going to be impacted a lot harder than people realize, in my opinion, because this is such lagging data. We have not seen the effects of these rate raises yet. We've seen some effects on, you know, interest rate risk that the banks took that they've gotten absolutely spanked on. But I do believe that there are a few things that could happen. Number one, we could have a credit event. And Bill, you were kind of, kind of hinting at that. And I do believe that is a distinct possibility and some sort of credit event that requires the Fed to step in and inject tremendous liquidity into the system. But look, we have this debt ceiling so-called deal that now we're going to turn around. The Treasury is going to float $1 trillion worth of bonds. And if they move that out to the longer end, then it's going to be difficult to keep liquidity in the system. If they issue shorter bills and T-bills, then maybe they can suck some money out of the reverse repo. But if they don't do that, liquidity is coming out of the system. It could be a little bit of a shock to the system. I mean, I do believe we're headed toward a recession, and it's going to require long-term some sort of QE and super easing of rates rather quickly into next year in order to come out of that. And we have a V-type recovery. So I, too, am super bullish long-term. But in the meantime, it's dicey.
James, I want to just maybe dig into that point, because I think a lot of people aren't talking about it. And that is the fact that the Treasury is effectively out of cash. The Treasury general account is hovering, you know, between $0 and $50 billion, which is very, very, yeah, very
it's
low.
Like, it's like you had $32,000 worth of credit card debt and you've got $50 in the bank. That's literally what's happening right now in the U.S.
Exactly. And I mean, today, when they potentially pass the debt ceiling deal, that gives them a license to start replenishing the account. And if they do start replenishing the account, that money is effectively going to suck out up to $1 trillion of liquidity out of the market. Why is no one talking about this? Why is no one, like, this is $1 trillion potentially out of the market. And, you know, maybe if they don't go for $1 trillion, they may go for $0.5 trillion. But there is money going to be...
Yeah, there's going to be money that's sucked out of the system, right? And so maybe Bitcoin and gold is kind of sniffing that out. And it's backing off a little bit here. Maybe it's also because the rates are going to likely be hiked because of this data that's contrarian to the Fed being able to pause here. That's also money coming out of the system. When you tighten and you raise rates, it makes it more expensive and profitability goes down. Which means that companies are earning less. They can pay out less. They have to lay off workers. Look, every single time we hear Powell come out and say, yeah, but the job numbers are great. They're very strong. You know, we still haven't seen any signs of a recession. People don't lose their jobs until the recession is already upon them, right? You look at the job, the unemployment numbers, and they spike after a recession begins every single time we have a recession. Go look back at the chart. I've got a couple of them in my threads, but you know, that's one of the issues that we're looking at. It happens super fast. So why are they not talking about it? That's a good question. I don't know why they're not talking about it. Sorry, Bill, I think I interrupted you.
Bill, you there?
Yeah, sorry. So a couple of things. One, I think the denominator in the Fed's employment numbers are based upon a 90s model of you know, full employment versus the service, part-time workers, seasonality, you know, base workers. And I don't think they're anywhere close to in tune with the times. And if you look at the people that are on the Fed and the people that are on this panel, no offense to anyone, we're probably all indicative of the same problem, right? I just don't think they're in touch with reality in any way whatsoever, right? Certainly not in tech, not in part-time employment, service industries, large box retail, et cetera, et cetera, down the line. And I really, really believe that, you know, regardless of how much they raise in treasury sales, it's going to be short-lived. And like I said, the liquidity is going to be pumped back into the system at an insane rate over the next 24 months. We may have blips down if the dollar strengthens, which I think is in sync with James's point. But I think you'd be crazy to try to trade in that environment and just accept the fact, you know, that whether it's 6 months or 18 months, the amount of M1 and M2 is going to go in one direction.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why, you know, I think that it's important to, like you just said, not to try to time this. If you go back to March 2020, if you tried to time that trade, that was extremely difficult. That was extraordinarily difficult. I mean, we were picking off the bottom, you know, a little bit, and we were buying on the way down, but it was painful on the way down. But to wait for the bottom, that's going to be difficult because of what you just said, Bill, is I think they're going to inject a tremendous amount of liquidity very quickly in order to shore up the markets.
Let me jump in, guys, and then I'll give you the mic right after Francis. First, a quick update. So Patrick from Binance responded to rumors from a couple hours ago. So the rumor was, I'll read it out, according to multiple sources who confirmed to Wu Blockchain, Binance has started layoffs and the proportion is still uncertain. The total number of Binance employees, and the list continues about how many employees. I think it says 20%. So Patrick responds a few minutes ago. Let me provide some additional clarity via a thread. I won't read the thread, just the first tweet. You can check the thread yourself. I'll pin it above. Binance is not cutting 20% of employees as a cost-cutting measure. Binance experienced true exponential growth these past 5 years and grew its staff accordingly. This was a historic operational challenge to overcome. And then the thread continues, I'll pin it above. I want to ask Wahid a question, and I see James dropped off. James, we'll bring you back up. Please do request and we'll bring you up. Wahid, a quick question for you. And I want the audience to give me their thoughts as well. We used to argue, me and you, now I'm not arguing with you as much, but you're, I would say, pessimistic, if you don't mind me saying, about the global economy and risk assets. I'm not sure if that will change if the Fed pivots. I want to get your take and kind of balance it out with you and Bill. Why are you so concerned? And for the audience, I want you to listen to Wahid, which is Faith Tribe. I want you to listen to Bill and other panelists as well. And let me know what your thoughts are. Are you bullish, as some of the panelists are? And I'd say I am bullish, or bearish, and if Wahid doesn't mind me characterizing him as such, as he is. Wahid?
Hold on 1 second, Mario. Can you explain to the audience why I turned bearish suddenly?
Liquidity.
Okay. So, okay, there's context here, right? I mean, I've been on your show, and for everyone to know that I've been quite constructive because I really did believe in the narrative that there's just too much debt around, and, you know, the liquidity spigots will not be turned off because they need to manage deleveraging. I always felt that the Fed put would always make sure that any accident, a la SVB or anything that we experienced in the last 2 months, would be met with a big liquidity push. And if you really think about it, that huge spurt that we saw in tech stocks and growth stocks in the last 2-3 months is very correlated to the expansion of the balance sheet. Given the bailout funds for the banks and regional banks, so notwithstanding QT. But I'm just going to give anecdotal evidence now of why I am nervous. And I was DMing Mario because I'm working on a specific project with Mario, and I'm kind of bewildered by what I'm seeing. And I texted him, and he was like, come on the show right now. So I apologize to the audience. Don't really know what was being discussed, but I assume it's the macro. And that is... it just feels like no one has got money, okay? I know that sounds crazy. They're big funds. They're people who I know are short of liquidity. There is very little liquidity. There are, okay, we are all in a food chain. I'm a certain size fund, under a billion, okay, in the hundreds of millions, but under a billion. I depend on the multi-billion dollar funds to help fund my co-investments. I measure up to those guys. And these guys are trying to scramble for liquidity from us. So I'm getting calls from people that, frankly, I would not have dreamt of getting calls from in the last few years. Okay? And the call is very simple. Everyone's scrambling for liquidity. In technology, outside AI, there is no liquidity. In VC, there is no liquidity. There are no secondary bids. And so...
And in crypto, focusing more on crypto, you would say the same for crypto?
So I'm
you
not
seeing
much
the same
in crypto, Mario. Obviously, Faith Tribe is on the blockchain. And that liquidity dried up 6 months ago, my friend. And short of like a few silly things like meme coins or whatever, that liquidity did not come back.
Bill, hold on. Bill, you gave him a thumbs down. Why?
Because it's not the absolute value of liquidity in the system that matters right now. Liquidity has been improving globally since November. Okay, I understand that banks, by and large, are not lending. That's not the pivotal issue here. The key issue is what's happening at the margin. Is liquidity getting worse? Is it staying the same or getting better? Most measures right now say that over the last 6 months, liquidity is actually globally has been improving. So does that mean that it's still bad in all the pockets? And I apologize, I don't know the gentleman's name, is talking about. Absolutely, right? I mean, we're a lender, so we know what's happening firsthand in the lending markets. But on the margin, which is what matters in terms of the value of assets on a relative basis, liquidity is actually improving. And I expect these recessionary numbers, particularly the PMI that we just saw, are going to create a floor on liquidity numbers as everyone is forced to pivot and support the system.
But I'm confused. So both of you are smart. Bill, you've been on the stage many times. Waheed, we have a personal relationship, and you've spoken on stage many times with Bill sometimes. So why is different information for both of you guys? Is it liquidity in some areas and not other areas?
It's not different information.
Didn't I just say in the last 2 months we had a monstrous growth, $400 to $500 billion in the Fed balance sheet owing to the regional bank crisis? Sure. You saw a lot of that money flow to the stock market. You saw a lot of that go to NVIDIA. You see a lot of growth bubbles. That, to me, is not the economy. You got $1.2 trillion in student debt that's no longer being delayed, okay, in terms of interest payments. You've got, you know, Rand talked about, I caught that part of the discussion, the huge flood of liquidity. You look at 2011, look at all the other debt ceiling, 2012, all the debt ceiling episodes, you had 6 to 9 months of liquidity drain. And I'm just telling you, in the real economy, be it housing, commercial backed, we know that, but homes, affordability metrics, all going down. There's no more liquidity in housing.
Francis, let me go to Francis. Francis, and kind of focusing on crypto, where do you stand on this? You saw different takes from Bill and Waheed, you know, with some overlap. Where do you stand on this?
Well, I think we have to look at where we've come from, because, you know, I keep hearing people saying there has been this giant kind of sucking sound as central banks generally have been taking liquidity out of the system, particularly, but not exclusively, the Fed. And so we would expect that things would be getting tighter everywhere, and that had a lot to do with the crypto crashes last year. And the intention is that conditions will continue to be tight. Even if the Fed pauses interest rates, you will still have tightness in liquidity, because that was the point, and it is still running off its balance sheet. I expect, though, we have got the debt ceiling raise coming up, and it's worth looking back to the last time this happened, which was actually September 2019, when we had a combination of events, one of which was the debt ceiling raise, which created a liquidity event in the markets, where and the Fed had to step in and provide liquidity. And I expect that if we have the sudden liquidity drain to fill up the TGA as we did in September 2019, that's exactly what the Fed will do.
Really interesting. Go ahead.
It's James here. Yeah, I would add that, yeah, I was quite baffled when I was looking on Bloomberg the other day. I saw liquidity conditions are improving. It just doesn't feel like that. And there's some really interesting work done by the American Bankers Association. If you look at credit conditions, they are the worst since 2008. I think that's a really important. That really shows you what's going on in the real economy, essentially. And you know, when you raise rates this quickly, this aggressively, things start breaking. And credit to Frances, she's done some brilliant work on banking, on the banking sector. And we're seeing quite a lot of malaise in the banking sector in the US and in Europe. I mean, we've got big names like Bank of New York with a CDS, a credit default swap of 150 basis points right now. And Wells Fargo is super high as well. I'm really amazed by that. It's not just the regional banks. And I'm not sure actually the banking problems are over. And particularly if the Fed's going to raise rates in June, that will be a further policy mistake in my view. You know, if you look at inflation, it takes 18 months following the first rate hike to really start it filtering through into the economy. So we've got some time yet before we see it in the inflation numbers.
Let me bring it to Haseeb. I want to ask you a question. Are you there, Haseeb?
Yep.
All right, man. There's a lot of money, you know, flowing into AI within crypto and outside of crypto. A bunch of people are sending me projects. The performance is mind-boggling considering the condition in the crypto space and the macro economy as well. Are we in a bubble yet? Because people like to say, hey, we're in a bubble, even in the early stages when the market just begins to start frothing up. Are we in a bubble? Are you worried? Are you guys deploying more capital in that space? I don't think anyone isn't. And should people in the audience, should they get excited about AI? Should they get involved? Should they work for AI companies? Should they invest?
Okay. Well, so first thing I'll say, I guess we are the only one who is not investing into AI. I don't think we've made a single AI investment. That said, we are a pure play crypto fund. So unlike Paradigm or some of these other guys who are going further afield, we only invest in crypto startups. Now, there's a lot of crypto startups we've seen that are trying to, you know, make some kind of AI meets crypto type play. So far, I've been pretty skeptical of almost everything that I've seen. Now, you asked the question, are we in a bubble? The answer unequivocally is yes.
Already?
Is AI real? The answer is also unequivocally yes. 100%. 1,000%. Right? What is NVIDIA trading at in terms of earnings? Something like 80x earnings, sure. Something like that? Sure. Like, we are absolutely in a bubble. And usually when bubbles happen, it's because people realize that some very important technology just arrived on the scene and is going to change everything. It's very clear that's where we are with AI.
But how is the bubble? Why so quickly? Hold on. Why so quickly in a bubble? Like, I feel like it just started, unless I'm late.
I mean, I think we're all caught flat-footed with how quickly AI has been accelerating. So it's clearly true. Look, with the advent of both Stable Diffusion and with GPT-4, everything has changed. It's very clear now. A lot of stuff that we thought, like, oh, maybe 5 to 10 years from now, you're going to have AIs that can, you know, basically do your math homework, or AIs that can, you know, basically do your analyst work and displace an analyst. We're there already. Basically, it's just a function of how you integrate these things into your workflows. And that, it's here. It's unevenly distributed. I mean, I talked to a lot of founders who are basically in, you know, in YC, in sort of these accelerators, founder circles. 2 years ago, if you were a founder that you had a, you know, basically impressive person with a good network, and you wanted to make some quick money, hire a team, do the fun startup thing. Right. A lot of people are just not quite cynical, but, you know, it's kind of like, look, I want to have an interesting experience. So I want to raise money and do something. 2 years ago, it was crypto. You find some fucking half-assed NFT, something, and you could raise money from somebody. You know, you could always make it work. If you were young, hungry, you had a good background, you could raise some money. Now it's AI. It's very clear. You know, I talked to a lot of founders who are floundering. The question they're always asking is, should I pivot into AI? 2 years ago, should I pivot into crypto? We're in that bubble. Right, people
100%.
Are investing huge amounts of money on zero go-to-market, zero traction, zero revenue, zero anything. And to be clear, there's going to be huge winners from this generation of AI, but we're also very clearly in a bubble dynamic right now.
Yeah, I agree 1,000% with that assessment. We're seeing people call things that are just basically wrapped ChatGPT new companies, right, and counting them in the market cap of AI. I pinned a chart above. There's something that I was talking about earlier. Everyone's obviously talking about NVIDIA. They seem to forget that NVIDIA has ridden basically every hype wave, including the crypto one, previously. I mean, you look at the chart up there that I pinned of NVIDIA next to Bitcoin. They peaked at exactly the same time when the top of NVIDIA stock was 69,000 for Bitcoin. They rode the entire wave down and have been effectively correlated in lockstep right until the last few weeks when we've seen that major bump. That is a sign that this is riding yet another bubble. It's now obviously decorrelating and going into the AI space. But I mean, Haseeb, to your point, most VCs who were passionate, quote unquote, crypto VCs are now passionate AI VCs, right? This is just the money chasing a trend. Now, I don't think necessarily that bubble is a bad thing, because with the internet bubble in the late 1990s, we saw the biggest companies in the world emerge from it. And I think that's what happens with each of these technological bubbles. But we're at that, in my opinion, we're already at that Long Island blockchain iced tea phase where people just start setting their AI companies and they aren't and get massive pumps as a result. I mean, doesn't it feel that way?
I totally. Look, here's the thing. I actually love bubbles. And I know that bubble has kind of become a bad word. I think bubbles are great because what bubbles do is, one, they make everybody stand up and pay attention to this new technology and try to understand, what do I do with it? Without a bubble, you know, things just kind of happen in the background. It's like, oh, IoT is happening. Oh, you know, my dentist's office is gradually getting better software. They don't really have the ability to dream big about how things can change in a really dramatic way, and especially have social conversations. Right? It's very clear AI is one of these technologies that we really need to talk about as a society, about what this means and what to do about it. And if AI is just sort of trudging along and things are gradually getting better, and you know, then that conversation never quite happens at the right time. So there are a lot of really great things about bubbles. One of the obvious things is that so much of the innovation happening in AI, regardless of all the money that's getting thrown around into NVIDIA and all these different random startups that are spinning up trying to do, oh, I'm AI for law firms, AI for dentists, AI for radiology, whatever. The reality is that the vast majority of the actual innovation happening in AI is happening in two places. One is OpenAI, and the number two is basically open source. And OpenAI doesn't, I mean, obviously they need money, but they can raise that money, no problem. That's a tiny fraction of all the money going into AI is going into OpenAI itself. And then second, open source is basically free. Like, these people aren't getting paid anything. They're just, you know, play around with all the stuff. But so they're in a way, they are the externalities. They are the outgrowths, like especially all the open source stuff. So much of it is basically getting subsidized by this giant AI bubble. And that's awesome. That's amazing. It wouldn't happen otherwise.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to note that just because we use the term bubble doesn't mean we're saying it's the top, right?
Oh, 100%. Very good point. To be clear, I think it's going to get crazier from here.
Yeah, in a bubble doesn't mean that the bubble is popping or anywhere near the top. I think that we could see 2x moves certainly on, you know, these sort of high beta speculative altcoins that have AI in the title before all of this goes down. And eventually it'll just revert to the mean. But I just have to think that, like, this hype around NVIDIA we've seen before, that will revert to the mean, especially if we believe that the market's going to drop. That's going to be the thing that goes up the highest has the furthest to fall.
Anyone you could see a 10x. Yeah. I mean, you could see a 10x in these things. The, you know, these kind of cycles with, you know, boom and bust are common. You know, we get bubbles in pretty much every kind of technology, going back to, you know, the automobile and the phone. And, if you, you know, you look at early adoption on these things. One of the more recent ones is the PC boom in the, you know, 80s and 90s. There was something like 3,000 PC manufacturers. And, you know, it was just like it was exactly like crypto, exactly like AI is now. It was like the hype. Everybody's like, oh my gosh, we're going to have a computer on every desk and in every home. People are going to have their recipes in their home. They're going to have a computer in their, you know, in their kitchen. And so you know, and that was right. That thesis was right. But you still had like thousands of companies that went under, and there was only a handful that survived, you know, Gateway and Dell, and you know, those were like super unicorns that came out of it. So you'll probably see that. I mean, we could see like 10x's and 10x's, you know. I don't know what the market cap of all AI companies is, but it's pretty tiny because there's so few that are publicly traded. But if you look back at like the .com, you know, that was another bubble, the .com bubble. You know, you had hundreds of companies, and they were public. Some of them, like pets.com, I think had hundreds of millions of market cap. And it had like, you know, their idea was like, they were trying to be like Chewy before Chewy was around. So you could definitely see that, you know, with this AI hype. But, you know, I agree that it's good for the economy. It's good for markets. It's a natural part of things.
Now, I can tell you, as a VC, like in the early stages is where you're seeing the most AI hype, right? It's striking to me how much basically two AI people who come from Meta or something, and just like a vague idea, pre-product, they have a deck, and they're able to raise at, you know, 60, 70, even 100 million without anything. That kind of thing is what I'm talking about. And I think this will find its way into the public markets, but right now it's really just too early. All this stuff was basically created like a few months ago, so there's no way for anything to be public yet.
Sounds like crypto. Sounds like crypto.
The valuations are insane. 100%.
1,000%.
But
what was that, James?
This is Bill. Sorry. I was just saying the valuations are clearly insane, but on the other hand, I've seen a lot of these boom and bust, you know, cycles, but I'm not sure I've ever seen a technology become so useful to so many so quickly. So it's possible that we have this kind of huge spurt of startups that just die for all the reasons that startups die over and over again in these cycles. But we still have an adoption of technology that's even faster than smartphones and potentially even crypto itself, right? I more or less agree
with that. 100%.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, but that goes back to the point of the bubble not being a bad thing, right? It's everybody rushes in, there's the gold rush, everybody gets rinsed, and then you see who the winners are.
We need that. We need that because it's the nature of those venture investments, whether and university investments, right? Blockchain's different because university investments now happen via tokens. But the nature of those investments is what creates the innovation. It's the desire to take part in something new and exciting and the riches that go along with that. That is what motivates a tremendous number of people and creates that groundswell of excitement. Even if 90% of the money is lost, that 10% creates untold riches.
I must jump in here and say, as I said yesterday, I did a show on AI yesterday. And then afterwards, a friend sent me a tweet, which I'll quickly retweet it on my account and I'll pin it. But it was 20 AI tools to future-proof yourself. And I decided to jump in and use these future-proof tools. I probably played with four of them yesterday. And within four of them, the impact on my business was immediate. As I said, I translated videos into multiple languages. I took 1 hour long videos, plugged them into the system. It gave me 10 clips, which I'm currently paying thousands of dollars for every single month. And you know, one epiphany that hit me is that this technology is kind of ready now. It need private keys. There's no contract hacks. There are no, you know, the impact is almost immediate on AI. Now, did this happen immediately? No, it didn't happen immediately. AI has been around for a long time. It's only now that the product is maturing. And I think that what's happening here is, I think blockchain is way behind AI because if you think about when blockchain started and when machine learning started and AI started a long time ago. Blockchain has probably had its V1 iteration. But I do believe that AI is now at the point where it is making a difference immediately, and it is the biggest difference that this world has ever seen, ever, and being adopted quicker than anything. And the worst thing is that it's happening without shenanigans. Like it's happening without. Yes, there is a need to regulate, and yes, there are.
Hold on. I gotta push back here. So look, I've spent the last 6+ years in crypto. One of the things you learn in crypto is that as a project becomes more sophisticated, more integrated, things start breaking, things start going wrong. Now, what is going to go wrong with AI? One of the very obvious things, totally agree with you. People are fascinated by the amount of productivity they can get almost for free out of integrating these applications into their lives. Every single day I see somebody saying like, oh, here's a ChatGPT, AutoGPT type thing that you can integrate directly into your email, integrate directly into your laptop. It'll just start like doing things for you. There's gonna be an overwhelming desire for people to integrate these things deeper into their lives immediately. Before they are safe, before we actually understand their security properties, we know enough now about simple things like prompt injections that I can guarantee you within 6 months, you're going to be reading stories about people who their entire life savings was drained out of their accounts because they connected an AI, like a ChatGPT, AutoGPT type system to their Gmail. And some attacker figured out some way to prompt inject something, take over that AI and completely fuck over their entire life. To a degree that we've never seen with any other technology. This stuff is very powerful. It's also very scary, and we do not understand it at fucking all. Agreed. And I think we're going to come to terms with that very soon.
And I think we are already becoming aware of that because I don't know if you've been seeing the number of articles I've been seeing about the threat that it poses, but it reminds me a little bit, ever so slightly, of the storm that there was, if you remember this, about Facebook's Libra. And we had governments coordinating around the world to stamp on it. I wouldn't be surprised to see such an initiative now.
Yeah, but I think the genie's out of the bottle here with AI. I mean, you know, you did see Italy trying to ban it.
There's no such thing as genie out of the bottle. Honestly, governments can and will stamp on things. That doesn't mean that they'll close it down completely. But I don't think, I was reacting to it without shenanigans, because that's clearly not the case. I think, though, that it raises a more fundamental question. And in fact, this has been a question that has been raised repeatedly, actually, through the period of social media, which actually I think has had a much more profound effect on the world than people realize. And that is how incredibly difficult it's becoming to tell what is real and what is fake. And maybe something that AI makes it worse.
I was talking about this today, and you know, when I did this, one thing that really struck me was how well it managed to get the voice right and how well it managed to get the facial expressions right. And then I was thinking to myself, like, imagine banks. You know, up until now, banks have called you and done, I don't know, kind of, my bank does a voice recognition but now this voice is actually my voice. So how this AI works is you give it a voice, and then it listens to your voice, and it trains the voice to be your voice. And I was just thinking, hold on a second. If this is my verification to the bank that this is me, it's a matter of a week or 2 weeks before people are going to phone my bank, use the voice recognition. Don't get any ideas. I can see there's like 10,000 people there recording my voice, but don't get any ideas. But I mean, this must be a nightmare for banks. This must also be a nightmare for like these crypto scams. I've seen people that take members of our staff here and create these crypto scams, and people have fallen for them. And they've said, well, you know, this guy phoned me. And I was like, well, no, he didn't. He's like, yeah, I recorded the video call. And they send us an AI. It wasn't as good as AI, it's these deep fakes or whatever they call them. But I mean, this opens up a whole can of worms in terms of fakes, authenticity. And this is maybe for me where the blockchain comes in, where, you know, the way to confirm authenticity is through using some kind of private key mechanism or something like that.
Digital identity. And we already saw a week ago, sorry, Francis, just really quick, I'm going to go right back to you, but we did just see a week ago an article in Cointelegraph that said AI deepfakes are getting better at spoofing KYC verification from a Binance executive. So people are already surpassing KYC on major centralized crypto exchanges using deepfakes. I mean, imagine that in an election, but that's a totally different conversation. Go ahead, Francis, sorry.
Yeah, I was about to say something similar, that I think this will force us to reconsider what we consider safe. So the banks have been moving more towards digital identity, iris scans, fingerprinting, voice recognition. And I think that the advent of this might force them to reevaluate all of that. We know that all of those can be faked.
I think there's two very separate problems here, though. One problem is, how do you verify you are who you say you are? And the second is, how do you verify that media is real? And I think the first problem is a very serious one, which is almost everything in our society, and no matter what country you're in, is based on outdated assumptions about technology, which is that it's hard to replicate voice. We already know it's very easy to replicate images with Photoshop. That's been true for like 20 years or whatever. But it's always been assumed, and so many systems which are very entrenched are built under the assumption that either one, you know, right now the reality is like you can fly with a piece of plastic, right? You take this piece of plastic with you, and that is what the government uses to authenticate, you really are who you say you are. You know, the reality is the systems on which we have built our assumptions around identity are pretty flimsy, and they're very outdated, and they're going to be forced to update very quickly from all the scams that are going to be enabled by AI. I think that's very clear. I used to work in anti-fraud before I got into crypto at Airbnb, and we saw, this was back in like 2014, 2015. Back then, it was already the case that it was possible to, you know, liveliness detection when you want to do some KYC to prove you are who you say you are, and it says, oh, look to the left, move your right arm up, that kind of thing. We already had algorithms that, you know, Chinese hacking rings were using in 2015 to generate these on the fly using an image of the victim. So this has been around, but it was expensive. It was complicated. Only pretty sophisticated people could do it. Now it's going to be super cheap and super easy. That's going to be a big problem for verifying people are who they say they are. Now, the second problem, which a lot of people talk about how blockchain is going to be useful for this, is how do you stop misinformation? How do you stop fake media? You know, okay, you know, you've got these two politicians making out. How do I know this is real or not, or this is some, you know, hit job by their opponents? This is the part of AI which, you know, Rand, you're also talking about this, oh, what if somebody puts out something where I'm saying something I didn't really say? The reality is, I think, this is the part that's going to be solved all by itself. I actually don't think this is a serious problem. Like, throughout history, there's always been, with the advent of every new technology, a new way to basically make up bullshit. And, you know, back in the very, very olden days with printing presses, it was, oh, people, you know, printed a fake book and said it was written by this person when it really wasn't. And then with the advent of the internet and Photoshop, oh, now you can make these two people look like they're in the room together when they really weren't. And human beings are fine. Like, society does not fall apart because you can lie about who said what, because you can make fake images. We figure out that, like, oh, hey, in order to understand if this image is real, I don't have to go and say, oh, I need... Well, let me finish my point, and then I'd love to hear your counter-argument. Like, the reality is that every form of media, what we learn is that, okay, if I see this image, the only way I know it's real is through video, because video can't be fake. That's not what people do. People learn to understand, I should be skeptical when I see something that doesn't make sense. If you see an image of Barack Obama making out with some random celebrity, your first thought is like, oh, I should find a video, and that's how I'll know it's real. No, your first thought is like, oh, where did I see this? Where did this come from? Did this come from the New York Times, or did this come from some random troll on Twitter? And that is what we're going to extend to video, to audio, to all these other media, because human beings are smart and they can adapt. So I think the answer to this is not, we need some grand technological, you know, matrix that we're all going to see exactly where every single individual media was timestamped, because that's just incredibly hard. In reality, this stuff is going to move so fast, there is no way we're going to move the entire supply chain of media onto a totally different architecture in time for people to adapt. People will adapt first and just learn to trust their own judgment the way they do about every other form of media.
And the media is perfectly capable of, the MI Times is perfectly capable of printing an AI-generated piece of bullshit. It's perfectly capable of, right now, of publishing things that are bullshit that's been published on social media, and it does from time to time. We have a problem with the way in which information is transmitted, the way the role that the media does, and how we can know whether what we're being told is true or false. And the internet and the social media have very much contributed to that. I think AI will make it worse.
Yeah, I think that it's a very lively debate. Bill, I see you have your hand up. Go ahead.
Sure, a couple points. I think in the short term, Francis is probably right that AI is going to basically exacerbate the issues of social media, confirmation bias, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, I think the genie's out of the bottle. I know you don't think that the genie can be out of the bottle permanently, but I do think in this case the genie's out of the bottle permanently. I don't think it's going back in the bottle. I think it's going to accelerate. I think the adoption is going to accelerate. I think the development of technologies is going to accelerate. I think Moore's law and Metcalfe's law as it relates to adoption is going to accelerate the adoption of these technologies, and there's nothing anyone can do about it. I actually, while I'm not taking to conspiracy theories, I do think that when I listen to Sam Altman and Elon talk about, you know, initiatives to slow this down, I actually think it's all pipe smoke and bullshit. I actually don't think that they actually believe that. I actually think that they're afraid of having Congress and other governments come down on them like they did on Elon Musk when he was talking about Libra. And I think they believe what I just said, which is the genie's out of the bottle. Or in Elon's case, he actually wants to play catch up with his own system, since he was investing in what he thought was an open system with OpenAI, which is now proprietary. And he needs time to do that. But I think in both cases, they probably think the genie's out of the bottle and nothing is going to be slowed down at this point. But the more important point to me is that I actually think that the integration of crypto and AI is going to really accelerate in the second half of this year. And I expect to see many announcements of new projects that integrate both crypto and AI to really interesting ends.
Scott, I'm not sure, you probably both, you and Ryan covered this. Ryan dropped out as always, he'll be back up shortly. But you guys have covered the Binance investigation, the CFTC investigation. What was your conclusion, guys? And panelists as well, feel free to jump in or put your hand up. But on the whole Binance fund, I know it's happened a while ago, but we never had the chance to speak about it. So it'd be good to talk about it now. Because we also know that Reuters just a few days ago put out a piece, which I thought was pretty kind of a nothing burger about Binance.
Hit piece.
Seems like a hit piece.
I've been loving, what's his name, Phil, whatever, the guy from comms from Binance. His responses have been just completely incredible to all of these nonsensical things. Listen, I can't speak to what's true, what isn't. I can only go by what we've seen. And I think to a very large degree, and I've said this about a number of players in the crypto space, I think that they started off in a Wild West mentality in an environment where there was zero regulation, and it was either move forward or wait 100 years until the United States came around and gave some sort of clarity. And so I would imagine that there were a lot of things that happened in the past at exchange and companies in crypto that were, I wouldn't, definitely not nefarious, but probably outside of the realm of what would be considered, you know, regulated or in line at this exact moment. I mean, CZ himself has made the point many times. I love it. I tell the story all the time. When I was speaking with him, he said, listen, it's like the automobile. He's like, you know, first they had the Model T and it was slow and there were five of them on the road and you didn't have to worry about it. But then cars got faster. There were a lot more of them. And the regulator came around and started to add seatbelts and speed limits and traffic laws. He was like, we were, you know, starting this exchange as the car before there was any law. And now we're getting in line with all of those regulations. Bill, I mean, listen, you run ABRA, obviously. You probably know more about this than anyone else. Do you think that aligns, or do you think that there's actually something nefarious here? That Reuters piece though, recently was just a hit piece in my mind.
Yeah, I'm going to skip commentary on the Reuters piece. It was just so awful. I couldn't even get through it in one sitting. I got angry and then came back and then read it again. And anyway, look, I think when it comes to CFTC and derivatives, and it's not really that different from the SEC, except the CFTC has probably less staff to do investigations. These things aren't really that complicated when it comes to offerings, right? I mean, either you're offering leveraged derivatives to Americans without DCM, or you're not. And I think at one point they were, and then they stopped. And so that's the end of it, right? I mean, if they admit that they did it, which I'm guessing that they already have, then in theory, that's the end of it. Then the question becomes, okay, their KYC is and you know, geofencing is, from what I understand, is pretty top notch now. And if you're not an American, you have very little chance of using Binance.com, as I understand it, unless you go buy an ID in the dark web or something like that. So I think we're talking about past transgressions. The only other option here, and I don't want to spread fraud because I've heard no specific allegations would be fraud, and I have not heard anything specific that would lead me to believe that there's anything there. So other than the very earliest days of Binance, where everyone knows that it was just like a perpetual ship at sea, and anything went, there's really nothing there that I can see. And everybody's had this company under a microscope for so long, you know, at some point you just have to say, okay, give the guys a break and the gals a break. They're doing what they say they're doing, and let's just get on with it. And yeah, okay, there's a little bit of a mea culpa for past transgressions, but honestly, that was at a point when anything went in crypto. You know, BitMEX was doing it, and Binance was doing it, and OKX, I think, was doing it, et cetera, et cetera. So let's just get on with it.
Yeah, that's exactly my point. I mean, I love to draw the sort of corollary to Tether, right? I mean, we saw Tether over the years become fully backed and compliant and change how they were backing.
Right.
I just think that in those early years, there was really no rules. People were doing wild things. I mean, BitMEX literally like had a prop desk counter trading their customers.
Yeah, Tether's right? Another one that ironically, if you're an American company or individual, high net worth, family office, they won't touch you with a 10-foot pole. As a direct, you know, counterparty for onboarding to acquire and mint and unmint Tether, which puts Americans at a very distinct disadvantage because, you know, Tether can depeg on marketplaces, but in theory, the mint can't depeg. And so it's just yet another example of you know, where a company that should be able to operate within the confines of the law, similar to Circle, has effectively been pushed out for no viable, discernible reason that I can ascertain, at least none that makes any sense. I'm sure that there is a legal reason why they don't want to deal with the U.S., but as an American, it's infuriating and makes no common sense to me.
Right, but all of this FUD and whether true or not about Binance, Tether, both of those companies sustained 5 billion plus 48-hour bank runs without a hiccup. And we 100%. Saw what happened in U.S. banks that are regulated when that happened.
Yeah, I think in the earliest days, I do think there was validity to the lack of transparency with Tether. I think they've come a long way since then. I think, like to your point, they've survived multiple kind of negative black swans, you could almost call them. Probably not the truest form of black swan, but pretty bad. Binance as well, but certainly Tether. I mean, I'll give them a lot of credit for not only surviving, but
trying to be transparent, and no big five audit firm will touch them at this point, right? So they're kind of relegated to you know, doing disclosures that probably don't look as polished or as kind of first rate as what a public American company would be used to, even though they're managing tens and tens of billions of dollars, because the traditional big five audit firms won't even take them as a client, which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, and especially when you see that they're doing billions of dollars in actual earning on a quarterly basis now on the back of high interest rates.
Yeah, right? Look, at the rate things are going, crushing it. At the rate things are going, they're basically now the Uber of money, right? Uber is a taxi company with no taxis, and these guys are a bank with no banks. And at the rate they're growing, they're going to be the biggest bank in the world. And basically be outside of traditional, you know, regulator oversight because they refuse to pull them in and give them a path to make it super easy, you know, to operate directly with Western counterparties. And I sincerely hope for everyone's sake that changes before they get much bigger.
Speaking of regulators, John, Eleanor, I want to talk about Ripple, obviously, because this seems to be coming to a head. Can you guys give us an update as to when we might actually see some clarity here, a final answer, what the prognosis is, and then we'll dive into everybody thinking, you know, I guess giving their opinion on what it could mean for the market.
Take it away, John.
Well, we're waiting any day from Judge Torres's summary judgment decision. All the paperwork is in. Both sides, the SEC has asked for summary judgment. Ripple has asked for summary judgment. On the 13th, a lot of people don't believe her decision will come before June 13th, because on June 13th, the infamous Hinman emails and SEC comments, that 63 emails, 52 unique drafts of that June 14th, 2018 speech, all of that is going to be unsealed with very limited redactions. She's ruled that way, which implies that, and she said in her order that the court declares these judicial documents if they impact her decision making on summary judgment. And so what role those emails are going to play or not play, we know that the CEO Brad Garlinghouse has tweeted that it will shock the public. We know that Stuart Alderode, the general counsel, has said it was well worth the fight of like millions and millions of dollars in litigation. So conventional wisdom at this point is that we won't see the summary judgment ruling until after the 13th of June. You know, which way it's going to go, who knows? I've been someone who said that the SEC may have snatched defeat from the jaws of victory because of the way they charged the case. They could have absolutely, in my opinion, proven that in the early years, when, you know, there was the ecosystem, the XRP ledger was only controlled by Ripple, and they held all the coins, that those initial distributions, sort of just like an ICO of ETH 2014 ICO, that in fact satisfied the Howey test. But instead, they went with this overarching theme that all sales of XRP, including secondary market sales, regardless of the seller or the circumstances surrounding the sale. In other words, XRP, they said, represents a security itself. And so I believe that the SEC is going to lose on that. That is an absolute unconstitutional expansion of the Howey test. It stretches Howey beyond any recognition. And a lot of people believe that she'll split the baby, and that she'll come up with some early sales that Ripple made, find them for them, and then argue that, you know, rule that today and ongoing and secondary market sales are not. You know, we're all guessing. It's up to Judge Torres. So that's where we stand.
And the secondary John, market sales will be the key thing, right? Because that's going to be the precedent that's set as to whether other crypto tokens are or are not securities.
Well, yeah, it's the whole reason I got involved, and it's why in the library case, after the SEC law won, the judge's order could be implied to be all sales of LBC tokens. And in the injunction that the SEC was seeking said all persons in interest. Well, that could be every LBC holder. So that's why in the penalty phase, I went in on behalf of Naomi Brockwell and said, look, judge, fine. You ruled against Library, not here to argue that, just like I'm not here to argue against, you know, ruling against Ripple. But it is absurd. There hasn't been a case in 76 years since Howey where an investment contract was held to be a security in perpetuity. In that, in every therefore, every sale thereafter, it's always around the circumstances surrounding the sale. And the judge in Library, we don't know yet, but I have a transcript. I can't publish it. He promised that he would make it clear that his ruling was limited to Library and direct sales and did not impact the secondary market. Now, there's some people who believe Judge Torres may leave that issue alone, and I'm confident and hopeful that she won't, because that's why I got in as amicus and said, hey, you know, you do whatever you want against Ripple, but, you know, saying that XRP itself or that secondary market sales are securities is absurd. And please basically make sure that you clarify that. And the judge in Telegram, her friend, Judge Castell, you know, basically said, look, the Graham itself, even though they were written contracts, Graham initial purchase agreements, those aren't the securities. It's the scheme surrounding the sale and all of those things. And so, you know, we'll see.
And those so, John, can I ask a basic question?
You know, very telling. I believe because the SEC has tried for so many years to hide the contents of them. So, you know, what is in them that they're trying to hide? I think, you know, whether it's a smoking gun, we don't know. And John, I think we've talked about this, but you know, there's definitely going to be something in there that brings light into the fact of, you know, kind of why this lawsuit was brought and why this industry is getting so targeted.
Bill, what's your question?
Can I ask you guys? Yeah, so John, I've watched these guys since day one. I've known Chris since pretty much day one. And this has gone on before the lawsuit for, I believe, almost 7 years in terms of both primary, secondary sales, usage of XRP and then the platform. There was a settlement, I believe, with either Treasury or DOJ, where they had to make code changes even, I think, in the earliest days. So which is proof positive that clearly the government was not ignorant of what Ripple and XRP was all about. How does the judge justify saying, okay, the SEC allowed this to go on for 7 years plus before they decided to bring these charges? I mean, that just makes absolutely no sense.
No, go ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, and why has not been brought up and used as, you know, some type of defense to say, hey, look, you know, regardless of what you may think, how could they allow this to go on for 7 years if they're so confident in their case? Anyway, and you get the point.
No, it's a great question, and I'll take the two things you brought up. What people need to understand, Chris Larson went to the SEC in 2013. The Treasury was there, Federal Reserve was there, CFTC was there, Chairman of the SEC was there, and he said, I'm introducing to you this decentralized payment system. 2 years later, that's when the FinCEN settlement came down, right. And they said, you must apply, these are virtual currency sales, you must apply to the banking laws. The SEC was in a sharing agreement with the FinCEN. They knew then in 2015. 2014, the year before, the United States Government Accountability Office listed XRP as a virtual currency utilizing a decentralized payment platform called Ripple. So you're 100% right. The government knew of this on and on and on for years. And to your second point about 7.5 years of publicly trading, why all of a sudden you bring this lawsuit and you allege this way, that goes to their fair notice defense. And so if the judge feels the way you do and feels the way I do, which is, you know, holding the SEC accountable, you know, the way that this all went down, she can rule that even if she finds that there were sales that met the Howey test, that Ripple did not have adequate notice based on all that government, you know, inaction and action that they didn't have fair notice, and therefore they have they can win on that. That would be a jury trial. So the a great scenario for Ripple, other than a flat out win, which a lot of people don't think is going to happen, a great scenario for Ripple would be, hey, from 2013 to 2018 or whatever date, let's say before their ODL pro platform, whatever, these meet the Howey test. But based on everything that you just brought up, it's going to be a question for the jury whether or not Ripple received fair notice under the law. And then that would go to a jury trial. That's a complete win for Ripple. At that point, I would never see the SEC going to a jury verdict where jurors are going to hear all of this conduct. Plus, the stuff that's in those emails, at a minimum, we know that XRP was discussed in those emails. At a minimum, we know that senior people at the SEC advised against giving the speech by simply saying that it's going to create more confusion. You know, why does ETH, you know, and Bitcoin only? What about the third largest? What about these other cryptos? There's going to be all of that dialogue going in there. And so the one thing I should say, I'm very confident Chris and Brad are going to win on the reckless charge, because in order to prove they aided and abetted Ripple in selling illegal securities, it must meet a recklessness standard, which means it's so obvious to a layperson that XRP was a security. So if these emails and these 52 drafts going back and forth at the SEC in 2018 are debating it, if the experts in securities are saying, hey, XRP doesn't look like a security or doesn't meet all the Howey tests, how could these two individuals know it back in 2013? And so the only other comment I would say is that the SEC wrote a memo. Now, it's been sealed as privileged, but they wrote an XRP Howey memo on June 13th, 2018. And we don't know what it said, but we know what it didn't say. There was no recommendation to issue a cease and desist letter to Ripple. So you can bet if the SEC enforcement lawyers said, hey, we've analyzed XRP on June 2018, it is absolutely a security, meets the Howey test unequivocally, they would not have not done anything. Instead, they just launched an investigation, you know, that went for 2.5 years. So,
yeah, what's interesting to me here is that I think there was an impression at the beginning within the crypto community that it was very polarizing. There's a lot of people that actually cheered for Ripple to lose because for whatever reason they hated Ripple. It was a polarizing company. Now I think that the silver lining is that seemingly everyone has galvanized and come together behind them. Also, of course, with the SEC going after Coinbase, people have, I think, are largely supporting them. But maybe the silver lining here is that the industry has had enough and they're all coming up behind this to support. But before you jump in, John, I want to say that was a great summary. Should we even care? This is a question I want to ask the panel right
now. That was my question.
Like, should we even care? Because if Ripple wins, and then that just goes back to the SEC, and the SEC just changes the way that they come after Ripple in a separate, right? So does it even matter? Will it affect the industry? Why is this important? That's what I want to hear people say.
And for and John as well, I want to ask exactly that same question, Scott. So I'm glad you asked it. What does it mean for projects that are sitting listening to us now, John?
Well, the first thing, a great question. The first thing is how many projects can afford $200 million in legal fees? Not many. And I've always been hesitant to, like, defend Ripple because I really don't care that much. I care about the XRP holders. But let's not forget that there was a 2.5-year investigation, and they didn't allege fraud. So I know that Ripple is a very controversial company, but you can bet your ass. I'm a former federal prosecutor. If there was a way to allege – if we're going to sue them anyways and we can allege fraud on a good faith basis, we would have, and they didn't. And so why should people care? Because we know Coinbase is up on deck. We know there could be a case against Binance coming up. This war on crypto is not ending anytime soon. And so this case, as each day progresses, gets bigger and bigger. If in fact Ripple wins or the judge accepts the fair notice defense, that helps Coinbase because Coinbase was given permission to give an IPO 2 years ago in April of 2021. Right? They submitted an S-1. They showed the SEC what their business model was. They even went to the SEC in January of 2019 about XRP and said, we're going to list XRP unless you tell us otherwise because we want to go public, you know, and we don't want to run afoul of what you think. And the SEC didn't discourage them. And so,
yeah, John, I agree. I think we all concur, like, the history of it is suspect at best, right? Bruce, I just want to jump to, yeah, Bruce, you got your hand up. I know that you have some takes on this.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great panel, by the way, but the couple things. What I can't believe is in this standard of, you know, in the financial world and in compliance, you know, anybody who's a professional knows that you have to be accurate with your statements. I mean, that's like a thing, you know, so I'm a registered broker. I learned that at like, you know, age 19 or something like you know, whatever you do, never, ever, ever, ever lie, be accurate. That's what like any good compliance person, lawyer will tell you. And, you know, as an SEC registered firm, we have all kinds of responsibilities. Our email is monitored. Our communications are monitored. Any FINRA member, SEC member, you know, all kinds of, you know, certain advertising has to be approved. You have to have communications with customers approved, advertising, even my tweets, even this, me appearing on this. All of this has to be approved by some kind of supervisor. And in some cases, you have to go right to the regulators. So what's astonishing to me is that everybody in our industry, whether you're SEC registered like I am and my firm is, or you're just a regular participant in this industry, you're held to this very, you know, high standard of truth. And then you have the regulators themselves who are not held to this standard and they can outright lie. And we have this statement that John probably can give you more details on it. But like what was a couple weeks ago where they said basically, you can't rely on these statements. So like the Hinnaman speech and stuff like that, you know, it seems like the SEC is like, well, you know, it doesn't matter what the chair says. It doesn't matter what the commissioners say. And you can have, you know, just outright, you know, false statements. You know, Gary Gensler makes false statements all the time. I mean, he's like, you know, some of the worst actors in our space. And if a registered firm or even an unregistered firm like a Coinbase had even a junior employee, I mean, if you had an intern who went on a crypto account and made a material false statement, they'd be in big trouble. And if a registered firm like us did, it doesn't matter. There's no excuse we'd have. It doesn't matter if the employee is not registered or whatever. So it's just astonishing. I don't know hopefully the judges will look at this, you know, kind of thing, but I'm just astonished that we can have, you know, this double standard where, you know, regulators are basically just allowed to lie and nobody's there to, you know, hold them to the fire on it. You know,
so Bruce, here's my next question. Okay, Brian, sorry.
I want to tell you something. I want to just maybe voice something. You may know that I moved to the United States. I was living in South Africa. I moved to the United States. One of the reasons I moved from South Africa to the United States is because there's a lot of corruption in South Africa. There's a ton of corruption. It's an African country with a ton of corruption. And I just felt like there was no point in living in a country that was getting pillaged by the leaders. And you're kind of fighting against the tide. And then I moved to the U.S. and I spent maybe 2.5, maybe close to 3 years in the U.S., something along those lines. And what I realized when I got to the U.S. is that there is much more corruption. It's just done at a much, 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 much higher level. Like, I just couldn't believe the level at which this corruption and politics was taking place. It made Africa look like Africa was a very let's call it an uncorrupt place, so that the corruption wasn't as sophisticated. And I will just give you like one example which I keep using, which for me is like a really really good example. Gary Gensler wrote and lectured an MIT course on blockchain. And it wasn't an MIT course on Bitcoin. It was an MIT course on blockchain. I've listened to it. I've listened to whatever's available on YouTube. I listened to it before Gary Gensler even became this critical against crypto. Now, you cannot tell me that the same person that spent time creating this course and lectured this course with such passion and enthusiasm is a person that is now so much against crypto. What it shows is that there is
corruption in the background, that there is political alignment, that here he's being used as the puppet to whoever the puppet master is, and I don't know who the puppet masters are in this case, to not actually do what he thinks is right, but to do what the politicians, lobbyists, money, I don't know who it is, because the corruption is so sophisticated in the US. You know, at least in Africa, you know. If the president's stealing, you know, because he's got private jets and Ferraris, and he's got 25 wives, and the 25 wives all have new cars, new houses. In the US, it's just so sophisticated that you actually don't know.
Look, I think this is unfair. Like, I criticize the US all the time in my spaces, okay? But that is giving you some numbers, and you know better than I, but giving you some numbers. The US is ranked 25th out of 180 countries with a score of 67 out of 100. So that's in terms of a corruption score. South Africa's at 69th, and I don't want to, you know, degrade South Africa. I don't mean that, so don't get angry at me. But it's a score of 44 out of 100. So my point is, the system is corrupt, and many examples of this. But when you talk about the corruption in the US being sophisticated, isn't that a good thing? I'll tell you why. Doesn't that mean that the system in the US is so complex that the only way they can get away with corruption on a smaller scale than countries like South Africa, which are significantly smaller countries, smaller economies, making it making corruption less prevalent than the US, which is the world's biggest economy. But the sophistication is a response to how advanced and how mature the system is in the US. So while we can be critical, I think it's fair, and I got in an argument with a few notable people whenever they compare the US to a third world country. That was, I'm just quoting exactly what they say. Do you agree with what I just said, or you still disagree?
I mean, I agree with you. I think it's just about the level of sophistication of the corruption, you know, and I think the depth of the corruption. I think corruption exists in all countries. I think I say all pretty loosely. I think all governments, and I think it's just, you know, I was quite disappointed because I think when I went to the US, I actually thought it would be different. And what I realized is that it's exactly the same shit. It's exactly the same shit.
So maybe, Brian, I can give you a perspective on
that. Bill, before you jump in, sorry, I don't want to be rude, just because I know Brian was trying to speak before Rand jumped in. I know you wanted to comment on something else, but if you can stick to this point, because you know, I don't tend to disagree a lot with Rand, and I'm a bit happy when I can finally disagree with him on something. I want to get your stance on this, because we talk about corruption in the US, but a counter argument is like, hey, the US laws are too strict, the requirements are too strict, it's difficult to operate in the US with all the loopholes you have to jump through. Which is kind of, they're there to prevent corruption, to prevent fraud, etc. And then some people, so the argument, the old argument was, and in some cases still is that the US is so strict on crypto and other spaces, let's just talk about crypto for now, so strict that people are moving out of the US. But then a counter argument is that investors are more comfortable investing in US-based companies rather than companies based abroad. So then doesn't that make two points? U.S. corruption is not as bad as people make it out to be. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and I know I'll get hate for this. I'm saying the things that people don't like to hear because I'm not running for president, so I'm just stating my opinion as is. And number two, is that a good thing for the U.S.? It just makes it more lucrative for investors in large flows and capital, especially post-crazy hypes and bull runs.
To me, there's two points. There's if this was another country, right, I think what would the headlines would be, why is this country going so aggressive against crypto? It seems kind of like a conspiracy. I think that's objectively how it would look. We just kind of, US, we think that they're, you know, a lot of people just assume they're doing the right thing. Now, when it comes to institutional level, and maybe let's talk about centralized crypto, right? I think there's some argument there that some regulation would actually be positive because it would bring in more money. You know, Coinbase stated publicly that they tried to go into the SEC and register, but they said they couldn't. So to me, that's a problem. Because if they could, if there was a way to do it without just getting sued in response or whatever is happening, then more money would be comfortable coming into the markets. But obviously, the regulator doesn't seem to want that to happen. So it seems like to me, there's inherently a problem. I do think that some regulation would be good on the centralized, you know, because then maybe another FTX doesn't happen, even though that was an offshore problem. But I could see an argument there of why that would make sense. But I think that the bigger problem is, why is it seem so conspiracy-ish on the general crypto side of that? There's just so much resistance, you know.
But Brian, you know, considering what happened in the last 16 months, do you blame them for the crackdown that we're seeing? Like, it's they need to do this first as an immediate response, so they save face, number one, because they failed in terms of regulation. And number two is, to, you know, voters are not too happy. People lost a fuck ton of money. So they're kind of forced to respond in that way. Because what happened is that we ruined, you know, we caused so much shit, like more than any of us expected. All of us expected the market to correct. All of us saw how frothy it is. None of us saw what happened with FTX. So we've caused so much shit. And then when the regulators respond in the way they did, and by the way, it could still, you know, it's the conspiracy behind it that this is a direct attack on crypto, and that bill, the Restrict Act being targeted to crypto, etc. Like, they make sense. I'm not saying it's not true, but what about the other way of looking at it is that we're getting what we deserve. And Bruce will probably hate me for what I'm saying here, because I know Bruce's take. He's been on the stage a few times. And Bruce, feel free to completely shit on me. I don't mind. And Scott, maybe give Bruce a question where it gives him the opportunity to shit on me.
Yeah, I'm ready. Here Bruce, here's the question that I wanted to ask that I put in the private chat, and I know you have a passion about it. But with all of this said, should we abolish the SEC?
Yes. The thing is, what Brian said is that you know, maybe we can prevent another FTX. And what Mario said is basically like, you know, we've got to do this, or the regulators have to do this to save face. But both of those statements are based on the premise that this would work. It doesn't work. The mistake that people make in evaluating regulation, they say, well, it's really hard and it hurts business and it costs a lot of money and it drains productivity and it stops startups from growing and it stops flowers from booming, but at least it stops the fraud. But that's not the real trade-off. It does all of those horrible things, but it doesn't stop the fraud. It doesn't stop the fraud. In fact, it encourages the fraud, because the more stupid regulations you have from, you know, nitwit Karen statists sitting in fancy offices that they paid for with the money they stole from us, the more that you have people trying to weasel their way through with loopholes.
Can I ask you a question? Sorry to interrupt, but it's a question on something you said. When you say the SEC doesn't stop fraud, now I can list a whole list of frauds that were, you know, where the SEC took action and brought them down. But more importantly, how many times do you hear people saying, hey man, Scott, hold on. Scott, we've had this discussion where we talk about different things, like, yeah, Mario, but I need to be careful because of the SEC. And I've had anyone I talk to in the US, yeah, but I can't do this, or I need to be careful, I need to think 2-3 times, talk to a couple of lawyers because of the SEC. So people are scared of the SEC, which is a...
But people worried about Stalin too. It doesn't mean that he was doing a good thing. People worried about, oh no, I better not say this bad thing about Stalin. I better not trade my food certificates with the other person's food certificates, because then I'll have too much toilet paper and the party will come and send the Gestapo into my house and kill me. You know, that doesn't mean it's good. Just because people are worried about the Gestapo doesn't mean it's good. You know, the regime that we have, yeah, sure, people are worried about it, but it doesn't prevent fraud. Their best pal, Sam Bankman-Fried, had unprecedented, unfettered access. He had more access than anybody. He helped them write their legislation. And this goes back for decades. The biggest fraudster in history is not Sam. It's Bernie Madoff. And Bernie Madoff was head of the largest regulator. He was head of the largest regulator. So regulations don't work. All of these apparatus, all they do is hurt the honest people. They allow the Sam Bankman-Frieds and the Bernie Madoffs to weasel their way through and commit even more fraud. And it gives people a false sense of security that they think, like, oh, well, I guess the government's saving me. The SEC is out to help me. They're not. They're out to help their cronies. And they hurt people. They hurt all the honest people. And they don't do anything. So when you say the SEC, you know, has stopped some fraud, but net, has it stopped fraud? Absolutely not. The whole ICO wave came about because it's so difficult to do anything in the U.S. So people looked at, you know, ways to say, like, okay, how can we not be a security or all of these other things? But, you know, ultimately the stuff just doesn't work.
Okay. So let me do this. No, hold on. Before you jump in, I've got a good response. I know there's a lot of hands up, but I've got a good response, Scott. And I don't have good responses often. So when I do, I use them. Scott, you mentioned yesterday, let me see if I got the numbers. All right. Share of total crypto market. These numbers are weird. What's the here list of top 10 countries with the most crypto users? Oh, wow. Okay. What was the share of the U.S., Scott? You did it. You said yesterday, of the total crypto market. Do you know the number, Scott? You mentioned it yesterday.
I'm not sure.
I know the numbers. Trading volume, if you want.
Okay. Give me a number for the U.S. because it makes my point. If you remember it, roughly, Ryan.
I about 15%
now.
Okay, so let's go 15%, even if it's 10%. I'm going to go through, that's the source here is chain analysis. I want to mention my sources to be careful, but chain analysis. No, that's not it. Where is it? Yeah, chain analysis. Percentage of crypto frauds per country. So total crypto frauds split per country. North Korea, unsurprisingly, is number one at 10% of total crypto frauds were from North Korea. Again, that's chain analysis. Number two is the U.S. Nigeria at 2.1%. Number three is Vietnam at 1.9%, India at 1.5%, Indonesia 1.1%, Thailand at 1%. The U.S. is sitting at, so Russia 0.09%, U.S. is 0.01%. The U.S. has one of the biggest shares in the market. I think China's above the U.S., isn't it, Ryan?
Not China.
No, not China. We classify it as Asia. China is very, very, very small. But
despite the
take Asia as a whole, it's about...
Okay, so the U.S. as a country, would you say the U.S. is number one in terms of total percentage share of the crypto market?
No, definitely not.
It's probably Korea or Japan.
Let's put it in the top three. Top three or top five. It's not even in the top 10 of total percentage of crypto fraud. So it kind of goes back to the point, and you've got a great panel here that could disagree with me as well. But Bruce, this is the point what I'm saying is that, again, there's a lot of flaws in the SEC. Maybe the world will be a better place without the SEC. But there needs to be some other alternative because, I'm giving anecdotal experiences where people are like, I can't do this, I can't do that, I have to be careful. And whenever they want to, there's the founder of a bunch of meme coins. What they do is they leave the U.S. or they launch the meme coin, they leave the U.S. They come to places like Dubai and stuff, which are still strict, but not as strict as the U.S., which I think is a vote of confidence. And you see VCs are more comfortable investing in U.S.-based companies. We're the same. So this is where I'm trying to make a counter argument, Bruce. Maybe I'll let you quickly respond before going to the rest of the panel, Scott.
Yeah, I think that it's the success of the U.S. is in spite of this. We used to be a free country. We used to let people in. We used to embrace economic freedom and opportunity. We let people start businesses, and that's been degraded, as we've marched towards communism and socialism over the last several decades, and especially this most recent administration. So it's kind of like in spite of it. I mean, we're a great country. We have the potential to be a great country, and in our blood and in our bones is freedom, but we're not living it now. The Statue of Liberty is just a symbol now. We don't let people in. We don't allow people to do businesses. It's much more like a third world kind of country where it's sort of who you know and what favors and how you navigate through this complex mess of statist regulation. So I think I think any success the U.S. has is based on, its past as a previously very free country that embraced these kind of things. But I just don't see any argument how these tyrants, the Elizabeth Warren crowd helps us in any way. I mean, Gensler and Warren, they don't help. They're a net negative, in my opinion.
Go ahead, Bill. You were up. You were waiting.
Yeah, sure. So look, I think I understand historically why this problem has evolved the way it has, right? If you think about the history of the United States, I think one of the things that historically made the United States so great and jokingly is relative to all the freedoms that Bruce claims we used to have is that the checks and balances in our executive, legislative, and judicial branches actually work, right? Under normal circumstances, Elizabeth Warren going off the deep end and making shit up actually doesn't really, sure, shouldn't really matter, right? The problem we have now is that we have regulatory agencies that over the past 50 years, and I'm not just talking about financial services, right? In financial services, obviously, we have the SEC, we have the CFPB now, and the CFTC, and the list goes on and on. We have the FDA, we have the FTC. These are all unelected, non-political actors who answer effectively to no one. And and there's been voluminous work done, for example, on how the CFPB in financial services has literally no oversight, runs more or less any way they want, finds banks with basically no checks and balances and no recourse, right? And that is the crux of the power base problem in the United States, because that gives Elizabeth Warren a power base that she otherwise wouldn't have. In other words, she can put Gary Gensler in her back pocket, even though there's actually very good, decent people in the trenches at these agencies, but the political appointees end up in the back pocket of politicians and do their bidding in a way that throws 100 years of checks and balances out the window. Okay. And that's what we need to figure out as a society, how to
undo. Can anyone back me? Ryan, can you back me up? Like, am I the only optimistic one about the U.S.? You know, if you look at various sources, for example, and I want to focus on crypto, but if you look at the U.S. for is rated number one for entrepreneurship and building businesses based on various sources.
I'd love to comment on that.
Yeah, sure. I'll go to Ryan and then Justin. Go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. And I wanted to make sure I got at least one comment in here before I rejoin in a little while. You know, I think Bill's right. One thing that I would note, so I'm bullish on the U.S. Obviously, I'm an American, and one of the things that I'm spending a lot of time on, as many others on this call, is fighting for sensible pro-crypto policy. And even if the numbers are only 10-15% in terms of users, and we still have an outsized influence on the capital markets. We still have an outsized influence just in terms of raw capital and the percentage of holdings that Americans have. And I think from a rule of law standpoint, you know, we have the Constitution on our side in a way that other countries, even those like Europe, which is a little bit more forward thinking from a regulatory side, just do not. So I still think that there's plenty of reasons to be super bullish on crypto in the U.S. if we can educate policymakers and have these hard conversations with them and as an industry to figure out what is common sense regulation and what should we be advocating for aside from leave us alone. The point about the SEC is a good one, and I agree with Bill and in terms of how we've got here. But the SEC is fine as an agency if it would just abide by its stated mission, right? The stated mission and the mandate of the SEC is to promote capital formation, protect investors, and ensure that markets are fair and efficient. No one is arguing that that should not be a priority for crypto and for every crypto marketplace, for every crypto custodian, for every innovator, for every community that's issuing an asset. You want some proper checks and balances. You want disclosures. You want fair governance. And you want security and safety. And the problem with this conversation and the reason it goes in circles so many times is the U.S. institutions and the good actors have been handicapped by this lack of clarity and this lack of policy in the U.S. And instead, it has pushed everything offshore, but in the most counterproductive way. It's not that innovation is fleeing America. A lot of the entrepreneurs are still here. A lot of the core builders are still here. Innovation is not fleeing America yet. That could change at some point if things get too hostile. But the good innovators have been handcuffed, and they've had to see their market shares erode, or they've had to see kind of competitors emerge overseas that have taken shortcuts. And it's because there hasn't been any sensible framework that would allow U.S. companies and even European companies, I guess, so the developed West, to provide safe, sound, secure, regulated services without crippling the underlying tech. So I think that's the battle that we have. And it's going to be, I think, a long haul battle. But the next 18 months is pretty formative in terms of just changing the narrative and making sure that we get back on track from a sentiment standpoint, because as sentiment goes, so goes policy, unfortunately, in the U.S.
Well, Ryan, I'm looking forward to your run for Senate, right?
After I've exited Messari and we've solved this problem and run a successful campaign for crypto, you know, then I will, I talked to Bruce too much. So I know how little
Bruce
I want to
do it. Yeah.
It's fun. Do it. Everybody
should
do it.
Run for Senate. I'll be back online in a little bit, guys, but, yeah, thanks for letting me speak.
Perfect. Justin.